From NPR News, a special report, hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This was the third and last day for nominee Kagan before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senior senators on both sides of the aisle are saying that she's come through with flying colors. They're predicting she will be confirmed. If she is, she will replace Justice John Paul Stevens, who retired this week. The final rounds of questioning were a little compressed because the Senate will pay tribute tomorrow to the late Senator Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia, and there will be no hearings or official proceedings while his body lies in repose in the Senate chamber. This day began with the most junior members of the committee, all Democrats, finally getting their turn. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island engaged General Kagan on questions of law in a kind of professorial chat. They talked about the constraints of precedent and the standards for overturning precedent. They chatted about the role of the jury in American law. Senator Whitehouse asked Kagan if the court should be deciding important matters on these very close 5-4 decisions.
I guess I want to ask you what you think about all these 5-4 decisions and what effort the court should make to return to a collegial environment at the court where even these highly contentious decisions like Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade are driven either by unanimous or massive majorities of the court rather than the slenderest possible majority, and to try to reach across the partisan divide on the court so it's not just Republican appointees acting together. Should there be any desire or motivation on the part of that group of five to reach their scope a little bit more broadly for the sake of the court, for the sake of the country, for the sake of stability in the law, and not be so content with 5-4 decisions?
Senator Whitehouse, it's a hard question you pose because on the one hand, every judge, every justice has to do what he or she thinks is right on the law. You wouldn't want the judicial process to become in any way a bargaining process or a log rolling process. You wouldn't want people to trade with each other. You know, you vote this way and I'll vote that way, and then we can get some unanimous decisions.
But on the other
hand, every judge has to do what he or she thinks the law requires. But on the other hand, there's no question, I think, that the court is served best and our country is served best when people trust the court as an entirely non-political body. When people look to the court as doing what we know it ought to be doing, which is deciding cases that come before it on the best possible reading of the law. And I think
And the court is capable of framing the decision that it makes in a narrower or more incremental way to attract a broader base of support on the court without necessarily engaging in log rolling or any of the behaviors that you sought, that you think are inappropriate, and I don't contest that. But there are ways to get to a larger majority without engaging in those, are there not?
Well, one of the benefits of narrow decisions generally, and there are a number of them, but one of the benefits of narrow decisions is that they enable consensus to a greater degree than broad, far-reaching decisions. And that is generally a benefit for the judicial process and for the country as a whole, to try to reach consensus on what it's possible to reach consensus on consistent with the law.
Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota shared with the committee that she had been up most of the night because of sneak previews of the latest Twilight movie. The senator apparently went as a chaperone for three teenage girls. She mentioned the vampire v. werewolf controversy and a grinning Kagan declined to engage. Klobuchar then switched from Twilight to Twi-Night and asked about baseball.
when Chief Justice Roberts was nominated to the Supreme Court and sat in the seat you're currently in, he famously told this committee that judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. He said that it was his job to call balls and strikes. And I was wondering if you could just talk about that metaphor. Do you think the balls and strikes analogy is a useful one, and does it have its limits?
Senator Klobuchar, I think it's correct in several important respects, but like all metaphors, it does have its limits. So let me start with the ways in which I think it's an apt metaphor. The first is kind of the most obvious, which is that you expect that the judge, as you expect the umpire, not to have a team in the game. In other words, not to come onto the field rooting for one team or another. You know, if the umpire comes on and says, you know, I want every call to go to the Phillies, that's a bad umpire. And is that your team?
Not exactly. The Senator Twins. Secretary. The Twins.
I was pointing to Senator Kopp, and I'm sorry. Same for the judge. You know, to the extent that what the umpire suggests, that there's got to be neutrality, that there's got to be fairness to both parties, of course that's right. The second thing that I think is right about the metaphor, and I think that this is what the Chief Justice most had in mind, if I remember his testimony correctly, is that judges should realize that they're not the most important people in our democratic system of government. They have an important role. Of course they do. We live in a constitutional democracy, not a pure democracy. And judges have an important role in policing the constitutional boundaries of our system and ensuring that other governmental actors, don't overstep their proper role. But judges should recognize that that's a limited role, and that the policymakers of this country and that the people who make the fundamental decisions for this country are the people and their elected representatives, whether in Congress or in the executive branch. And I think that that's right, too, as I've tried to say on many occasions throughout these hearings. I suppose the way in which I think that the metaphor does have its limits, and I believe that this is in line with what Mr. Ayers was talking about, was that the metaphor might suggest to some people that law is a kind of robotic enterprise, that there's a kind of automatic quality to it, that it's easy, that we just sort of stand there and, you know, we go ball and strike and everything is clear cut, and that there's no judgment in the process. And I do think that that's not right, and it's especially not right at the Supreme Court level, where the hardest cases go, and the cases that have been the subject of most dispute go. And as to that, I think that there is judges do, in many of these cases, have to exercise judgment. They're not easy calls.
One role of the senators on the president's side of the aisle is to bat cleanup, to give the candidate an opportunity to speak again about something she's already been asked to talk about. A pitch right over the plate came from Ted Kaufman, the senator from Delaware, who asked Kagan about her background working for Democratic politicians and whether that would influence her decisions on the bench.
The greatness of our judicial system lies in its independence. And that means when you get on the bench, when you put on the robe, your only master is the rule of law, and you know, regardless what political administration you might have worked for in the past, and there are many justices on the court who have worked for either for Congress or for the executive, but just like all of them have, I would, if I'm fortunate enough to be confirmed, you know, put on that robe and be independent and not favor any political party.
I'm joined by Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, and Tom Goldstein, founder of the SCOTUS blog and an attorney at the law firm Akin Gump. Welcome to you both. Let me ask you, on this third day, what was the mood in the room? Did people, were they forces of Kagan seeming encouraged?
Tired. Tired was the mood from everybody, I think.
Yeah, yesterday was such a long day, both for her and for them. I also thought, with some exceptions, there wasn't a lot of the lightness and humor that we got. They all seemed very relaxed together yesterday. It started kind of flat because it was just the Democrats kind of making points about the conservative Roberts Court. But then it picked up because there were a few real attempts by Republicans to score some points, and that created some tension.
There were several mentions of the chief, John Roberts, starting with that baseball metaphor. She said that it works, but only up to a point.
Well, you know, I was struck today by how John Roberts, the Chief Justice, the conservative Chief Justice of the United States, was almost as much a presence in that hearing room as Elena Kagan. And that's because the Democrats were, you know, beating him up and feeling that they'd been suckered by him at his confirmation hearing and making that point over and over and over again.
And Senator, the other candidate would sit here, he'd make promises, then he'd sit a go on the court.
Yes, and the last person to make that point in very stark terms was Arlen Specter, who was, of course, then a Republican when that hearing took place. In fact, he was the chairman of the committee. And it was really striking. Now, the umpire metaphor has been brooded about a good deal, and no lesser person than Judge Richard Posner, who's sort of a conservative icon, has disputed the metaphor. But it was an overall theme today.
The judge's justice's role, apparently, according to Elena Kagan, is a little more active than that one.
Yeah, she did say she didn't want to throw the metaphor away entirely because it does have a nice image of neutrality. But she really did give some of the critique of the left of it, that we're not machines here. We're not a computer.
You
don't want somebody like that on the Supreme Court. You want somebody that you're going to really trust their experience and judgment.
Thank you both very much. We will have Nina Totenberg and Tom Goldstein back with us throughout this hour. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you are listening to a special report from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, you're listening to a special report on hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the nomination of Elena Kagan to be on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This was Kagan's final day of questions before the committee in public. She's met with members privately, and she's been publicly questioned, and now she has to get their votes in order to move her nomination on to the full Senate, where committee Republicans and Democrats are saying this evening they do expect she will succeed. After a kind of legal seminar with the committee Democrats, Elena Kagan faced a second round with Republicans, who still had a few questions to raise with the nominee, starting with ranking member Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who questioned whether Kagan upheld her responsibilities as the Solicitor General to defend the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell law, a law Kagan has said she personally opposes.
It's important to me, based on your representation to the court, that I understand that you were fully committed to vigorously defending that law, because I think that was your responsibility, and it was an oath you took.
Sessions' concern was that given Kagan's personal opinion about the military policy toward gays and lesbians, that she didn't go as far as she ought to have done in defending the law. He noted several challenges to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which had worked their way through the courts with varying decisions, including a decision in the Ninth Circuit based in San Francisco, which Sessions thought weakened the government's position. He asked her why she didn't appeal it.
I agree with you, Senator Sessions, that the Ninth Circuit decision undercuts that statute. It makes it harder for the government to carry out its policies under that statute. And the question that we had to decide was whether to challenge that Ninth Circuit decision, which I think is in real tension with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell statute. The question we had to decide was whether to challenge that Ninth Circuit decision at an early stage or at a late stage of the case. It was a matter of timing. And we talked a good deal about this, of course, amongst ourselves, but also with the Department of Defense. And we decided that the better course was actually to wait on it and to accept the court's remand. The case is not at all closed. Instead, the case is on remand in the district court to take that remand. And in the event that we didn't win the case on remand, or in the Ninth Circuit again, in that event, then have the option to, and presumably would, take the case to the Supreme Court to challenge the Ninth Circuit's holding.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, who's a Republican, continued today with an issue which has been much discussed, the nominee's handling of military recruiters at Harvard. The issue, in part, is that Harvard refuses access to organizations which discriminate against, among others, gays and lesbians. And that is in conflict with the military policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Kagan said that while military recruiters were not permitted to use the facilities of the career offices at Harvard, they were permitted on campus. Here's Senator Hatch.
The law requires the same access to campus and students for the military as other employers receive. The Harvard Law School Veterans Association has said that they had a tiny membership, meager budget, and no office space. All they could do was facilitate a few student-initiated contacts with military recruiters. All they could do was establish an email account to receive inquiries from students. Now, is this what you referred to yesterday as, quote, full and complete access to our students, unquote? And did you believe that this was an equal substitute for what the Office of Career Services provided for all other employers, all other legal employers?
Senator Hatch, I did believe that it was an equally effective substitute, that what our Office of Career Services does, they do a good job, but what they do is basically no more than to ensure that students know when an employer of any kind is coming, and to enable the student and the employer to hook up with each other. And that's what our Office of Career Services do. We have upwards of 700 or 800 employers that come to our campus every year. And what the Office of Career Services does is to make sure that students know when those 700 or 800 employers are coming and where they're going to be, and to make sure.
You have to admit that the facilities weren't as available to the military, to the recruiters, that they would have been with the office that you're describing. I mean, let me make that point a little bit more clear, maybe. Yesterday, you also said that the military, quote, the military at all times during my deanship had full and good access, unquote. Now, the Judge Advocate General's office, however, stated that without access to the Office of Career Services, quote, we are relegated to wandering the halls in hopes that someone will stop and talk to us. It is our view that denying access to the Career Services office is tantamount to chaining and locking the front door of the law school, as it has the same impact on our recruiting efforts, unquote. Again, I'm not asking whether recruiting went up or down or whether there was some access to something at all time. The law requires the same access for the military as other employers, not access that the dean may consider good. Do you disagree with this description of the situation by the Office of the Judge Advocate General?
Senator Hatch, I appreciate that reasonable people can disagree about this issue. But I do think that the military at all times, regardless whether the Office of Career Services was sponsoring or the Veterans Association was sponsoring, had excellent access to our students. And over many years prior to my deanship, the Veterans Association had sponsored. The Department of Defense had thought that sponsorship was fully adequate to their needs. And I think that there are other documents in those records which suggest the Department of Defense going in and saying, we met with a lot of people and it was great, and we very much appreciate the access that we were getting. The Office of Career Services really exists as a kind of It makes sure that students know that employers are coming, and it makes sure that students have the opportunity to talk with those employers. The Veterans Association did a fabulous job of doing the same thing, and so I do think that the military recruiters had excellent access either way, and in fact, that semester in my deanship, the one period of 12 in which the Veterans Association did sponsor the interviews, in that year, military recruiting did go up, and I do think that the, you know, effects in some sense speak for themselves.
Senator Hatch also brought up partial birth abortion, an issue that was very much a concern of the Clinton administration, and cited a document in Kagan's handwriting, which he said indicated that she had caused an important medical association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, ACOG, to revise its opinion of legislation on partial birth abortion in a way that was helpful to the Clinton administration.
Did you write that memo?
Senator, with respect, I don't think that that's what happened here.
I'm happy to have you clarify. That's my question. Did you write that memo?
I'm sorry, the memo which is...
The memo that basically caused them to go back to the language of medically necessary. That was the big issue to begin with.
Yes, well, I've seen the document, and the document
But did you write it? Is that your memo?
The document is certainly in my handwriting. I don't know whether the document was a product of conversation that I had had with them. If I could just go back, Senator Hatch.
Okay.
This was an incredibly difficult issue for everybody who was associated with it for obvious reasons. The President Clinton had strong views on this issue. Uh-huh. And what he thought was that this procedure should be banned in all cases except where the procedure was necessary to save the life or to prevent serious health consequences to the woman. And those were always his principles. And we tried over the course of the period of time when this statute was being considered, actually twice, to get him absolutely the best medical evidence on this subject possible. And it was not easy because, as everybody in Congress knows, different people said different things about this. There was conflicting evidence. And we tried to do our best to bring all the evidence, all the conflicting views to his attention. In the course of that, we did indeed speak with ACOG. ACOG had an interest in this statute, and ACOG had views about this statute. What ACOG thought and always conveyed to us was two things. What ACOG thought was that, on the one hand, they couldn't think of a circumstance in which this procedure was the absolutely only procedure that could be used in a given case. But second, on the other hand, that they could think of circumstances in which it was the medically best or medically most appropriate procedure, that it was the procedure with the least risk attached to it in terms of preventing the harm to the women's health. And so we knew that ACOG thought both of these things. We informed the President, President Clinton, of that fact. There did come a time when we saw a draft statement that stated the first of these things, which we knew ACOG to believe, but not the second, which we also knew ACOG to believe. And I had some discussions with ACOG about that draft.
My time is about up. Let me just ask that question again. Did you write, quote, "This, of course, would be a disaster," unquote? You didn't get that from the information.
No, you're exactly right. I'm sorry, I didn't realize
that's
you were referring.
That's what I
wanted
to know.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And the disaster would be if the statement did not accurately reflect all of what ACOG thought.
There was another tussle on the Democratic side once again with newly converted Democrat Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who, by the way, lost his primary and therefore will be retiring at the end of this Senate term. As she did yesterday, Kagan declined to answer questions from Senator Spector on a series of legal matters he thought she ought to talk about, including a relatively obscure area, a standard the court uses in reviewing the constitutionality of legislation. Kagan declined to say whether she agrees with the standard without discussing it with her colleagues.
If you have to discuss with your colleagues the kinds of questions that we're raising, that I have just raised, you wouldn't answer anything. And perhaps you haven't answered.
Well, Senator Spector, I certainly do have to read briefs.
Perhaps
and
you haven't answered much of anything.
Senator Spector, I do have to read briefs and listen to arguments and
why
discuss.
Why do you have to read briefs on a standard? This is not a specific case.
This is,
a standard as to whether the rational basis is sufficient or whether you're going to have congruence and proportionality.
Senator Spector, the congruence and proportionality test has been a standard that's been adopted by the court that is precedent going forward. And you shouldn't want a judge who will sit at this table and who will tell you that she will reverse a decision without listening to arguments and without reading briefs and without talking to colleagues, notwithstanding that that person knows that that test has been subject to serious criticism.
Well, Solicitor General Kagan, I think the commentaries in the media are accurate. We started off with the standards that you articulated at the University of Chicago Law School about substantive discussions, and they say we haven't had them here, and I'm inclined to agree with them. The question is where we go from here. You have followed the pattern which has been in vogue since Bork. And you quoted me in your Law Review article that someday the Senate would stand up in its hind legs. It would be my hope that we could find some place between voting no and having some sort of substantive answers. But I don't know that it would be useful to pursue these questions any further.
That was one of the testier exchanges on the Democratic side. I'm here with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, along with Tom Goldstein, who's the founder of SCOTUS blog. Spector was very tough on the question of whether Kagan is responsive and dropped a very large hint that he hoped that there would be something to be done between that and voting no on the nomination.
Well, you know, you have to remember that Arlen Specter is a real believer in senatorial prerogatives, and he has been consistent on this. Way back in the 1980s, when William Rehnquist was nominated for Chief Justice by President Reagan, and Arlen Specter was a Republican in those days, he asked Rehnquist a series of questions that Rehnquist refused to answer, in much the way that Kagan refused to answer today. And Rehnquist said, you know, I really don't have to answer those questions. And Spector said, and I don't have to vote for you. And he made it very clear he was prepared to vote against him, at which point the Reagan White House folks got to Rehnquist and said, you're going to have to answer this question, which he did the next day. And that ended that. But you have to be that tough, particularly, and it was especially tough, given that this was a nominee of his own party's president. You have to be that tough to force it, and you have to be willing to vote no. And most senators from the party of the president are simply not willing to do that.
The Republicans were kind of harsh with Kagan on social issues today. They talked about abortion, about don't ask, don't tell. But it wasn't, I'm not sure how it worked. I mean, she never seemed at any kind of a loss on any of this. She never seemed stung by it, did you think, Tommy?
No, I thought she was very prepared on the documents that they were going to use. There was an effort to reach back to her time in the Clinton administration, where she was obviously, you know, advocating for policies on the Democratic side, on the more liberal side, for example, on partial birth abortion. I do think personally that the Republican senators succeeded in showing their own base why it is that they should be concerned and why it is that they were going to vote against her. But that's a very different thing from showing the rest of the country that there was something to be really concerned about and trying to motivate opposition.
I think you underrate the base. I suspect that the base was upset
with a lot of Republicans for not being tougher on her, just as the left base was very upset with Democrats for not being tougher on Roberts and Alito. The left certainly felt that there wasn't enough really good aggressive questioning. And I'll bet you, you know, it's not as if we really know what either of the wings are talking about to each other, but I'll bet you that there was a good deal of unhappiness for not having enough aggressive questioning.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It is striking how much the senators do like to show respect. It's talked about in those terms as an institution. They seem to really genuinely, with some exceptions, want to let her get her answers in. They do want to be polite to her. And I do think the more aggressive members of each side would really like to see some pounding.
They would, but there'd be a bite back, too. It's a very careful line you have to walk.
So just off the top of your head, does she lose a Democrat? Does she gain any Republicans out of this committee?
I think she might well get Graham out of the committee. The only Democrat it looks to me like she might possibly lose would be Specter. And in part, that's because he's on his way out the door.
When we come back, we'll have more from the hearings and from Nina Totenberg and Tom Goldstein, and we hope you will stay with us. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you're listening to special coverage from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, this is a special report. Hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Solicitor General Elena Kagan to be the next justice on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and it's all over but the voting for Kagan. Members of both parties have complimented her during the day today about how she's come through the hearings. Some of them have told reporters during the breaks they now expect her to be confirmed by the Senate. However, Republicans did have a few more bones to pick with Elena Kagan today. Senator John Kyle of Arizona appeared to take offense at a letter sent to senators by Kagan and three other law school deans in 2005, objecting to the possibility that Congress would strip courts of the power to review what happened to prisoners being held at Guantanamo.
I considered your language injudicious when you compared our actions to, and I'm quoting now, the fundamentally lawless actions of dictatorships. And I wonder why you felt, obviously you felt strongly about this, or you wouldn't have used those words, but why did you feel it necessary to describe what we were proposing in those terms?
Senator Kyle, I don't think we did, or at the very least we did not mean to compare you to dictators. The only thing that the letter was meant to say was that we should hold ourselves to very high standards, at least as high or higher than the standards that we would apply to dictatorships. And those were the standards that we were urging Congress to hold itself to in considering this legislation. And Congress, in fact, did. I mean, within a matter of days, Congress came together, 84-15, a remarkable act of bipartisanship, and passed a very good piece of legislation, which did provide Article III review of military commission determinations.
There was more to it than that, though. You suggested in the letter that the habeas rights of which you were speaking should apply beyond Guantanamo to foreign theaters of war. You wrote, and I'm quoting now, "We cannot imagine a more inappropriate moment to remove scrutiny," and the scrutiny is equivalent here to habeas jurisdiction, "of executive branch treatment of non-citizen detainees. We're all aware of serious and disturbing reports of secret overseas prisons, extraordinary renditions, and the abuse of prisoners in Guantanamo, Iraq, and Afghanistan." Now, if abuses exist in all three places, the obvious import of your argument was that the reach of habeas should extend to Guantanamo, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Senator, I think that the focus of the letter, as the focus of everybody's attention at that time, was on the Guantanamo detainees. And as you know, I've as Solicitor General, I've advocated strongly, and I made sure that my name appeared as counsel of record on the United States government's Bagram brief because I believed that the United States has very strong interests in this.
Here's my question. That is the position you took as Solicitor General, dealing with the rights of habeas ad Bagram. You expressed a personal opinion before that. This issue could well be presented to the court. And what I want to know is whether or not it'll be the position you argued on behalf of a client, the United States, or what was personally in your heart and caused you to write with such passion to members of the Senate here.
Well, the letter, I do think, was focusing on Guantanamo detainees and was focusing on two questions.
But it wasn't limited, and you specifically went out of your way to include also Iraq and Afghanistan in the same clause.
I think we can argue about the letter, the legislation, and whatever.
So what is your personal view, then, that it would not apply to Bagram, just to use a very specific example? As you argued in the Michaela case?
Senator Kyle, I'm Solicitor General. The view that I have advocated, and I have advocated it strongly, including by signing my name on a Court of Appeals brief, which the Solicitor General almost never does, is that habeas should not extend to Bagram. Now, I couldn't comment. I would be recused from that case that I signed my name on. This decision might come to the court.
But if I can just interrupt, you understand what I'm asking here. If a case similar to that came to the court and you didn't recuse yourself, I don't know whether you take the position that you argued on behalf of a client or you take the position that was apparently on your heart when you wrote this letter to us.
Well, Senator Kyle, I don't think that that letter expresses a view on the question of habeas rights at Bagram. I think that that letter was focused on the Guantanamo issue.
Senator Kyle also reminded Kagan that in her previous confirmation hearing to be Solicitor General, the position she holds now, she had said there was no constitutional right to same-sex marriage. When Senator Kyle brought it up, he referred to the Defense of Marriage Act, which he calls DOMA.
That DOMA's constitutionality is a different question than your statement, and there were no qualifications on it. You said there is no federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage, period. Now, are you qualifying that now? Are you saying that you meant something different by those clear words that you expressed to Senator Cornyn? And I didn't take it out of context.
I was absolutely saying that I understood the state of the law and that I accepted the state of the law.
Saying then that as of right now, the court hasn't declared there to be a federal constitutional right. Is that all you're saying?
I am saying that very much understood, accepted the state of the law, and that I was going to perform all my obligations as Solicitor General consistent with that understanding and consistent with that acceptance.
So you wouldn't tell us today, then, whether you believe that the Constitution could be properly read to include such a right?
I don't think that that would be appropriate. As Senator Grassley and I talked about, there is a case that's pending. The case may or some other case might come before the court, and so I couldn't go any further than that.
So then when you said there is no federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage, what you meant by that was the court has not held that there is a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
The question was, could I perform my responsibilities as Solicitor General? Did I understand the law? Did I accept the state of the law? And the answer was yes as to both.
The issue which appears to have had the most traction for Republican members of the committee is what Kagan did with military recruiters at Harvard. We heard about it every day at these hearings. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina brought it up again late in the day, wanting to know what kind of access to Harvard students military recruiters really had.
Senator Graham, the recruiters could have met on campus as well.
That's what I'm saying. It wasn't a ban. It could have come to the law school.
And could have met on the law school campus. The only restriction that we put on was that the Office of Career Services couldn't provide assistance.
Which is the place where most students met employers.
No, it's just an office, really. I mean, most 95% of interviews from employers at Harvard Law School.
But here's the point. It's clearly not just an office. It was a political statement that you were making, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me you were making a political statement. You're not taking the law in your own hands, but you're trying to make a political statement on behalf of the law school that this office is not going to be used by the military because we don't like this policy. Is that a fair statement or not?
Senator Graham, I think what I was trying to do was, on the one hand, to ensure military recruiting, on the other hand, to enforce and to defend the school's very longstanding anti-discrimination policy. So it wasn't me making a political statement. It was me as dean of the law school, and that's what I was. I had an institutional responsibility as dean of the law school trying to defend an anti-discrimination policy that had existed for, I don't know, 25 years.
Would it apply to the Catholic Church if they wanted to come and recruit lawyers from the law school because they don't have women priests?
Well, the way we enforce this policy is if an employer comes, we give the employer a form. And the form basically says, you know, I comply with the following policy. And it says, I will not discriminate on the basis of. And then it says something like race and creed and gender and sexual orientation and actually veteran status as well. Okay. And if the employer signs the form, the employer can get the services of the Office of Career Services, and if not, not.
Okay. So it wasn't a political statement on your behalf at all? You weren't trying to tell the world what Harvard Law School thought about this policy?
It was not, Senator Graham. Okay. I was just trying to defend a very long-standing and
it would have been okay with me if it was. I just disagreed with you, but I'll take you at your word.
When the Judiciary Committee has had the opportunity to question nominees to the High Court, which has happened four times recently, some of the committee Republicans have pressed nominees on their views of the Constitution. How literally do they take the text of the founding documents? What sort of interpretation do they think is appropriate? Here's Senator John Cornyn of Texas.
I want to get your thoughts on this statement of constitutional interpretation. And it starts this way. Original understandings are an important source of constitutional meaning, but so too are other sources that judges regularly invoke. The purpose and structure of the Constitution, the lessons of precedent and historical experience, the practical consequences of legal rules, and the evolving norms and traditions of our society. Do you generally agree with that statement, or is there any part of it that you disagree with?
You know, I think what I've said is that you look to text, you look to structure, you look to history, very much including and very especially the original understandings, and you look to precedents. And in one or another of cases, one of those may be more important than others of them. In some cases, you might look to all of them. And that's a kind of pragmatic approach, not an approach that takes a sort of grand, overarching, philosophical view as to, you know, it's just one thing, and it's got to be that one thing in every case. And that's the way I would approach the.
And that's consistent with what you've said as I've heard you testify yesterday and today. And really the part of it that I was interested in was the last phrase, which talked about evolving norms and traditions of our society. What role do you think a judge's opinion of the evolving norms and traditions of our society have in interpreting the written Constitution?
Well, I think that traditions are most often looked to in considering the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment. I think every member of the court thinks that the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment applies to more than physical restraints. And I think almost every member thinks that it gives some substantive protection and not just procedural protections. And then the question becomes, what substantive protections does it provide? And I think the best statement of the approach that the court has used is actually Chief Justice Rehnquist's statement in the Glucksberg case, because he says he basically agrees with both of those things, that the Due Process Clause provides substantive protection and means more than restraint from physical restraint. But then the question is, well, how do you define that? And how do you appropriately limit that? Because it's for sure the case that the courts should not use that clause to appropriate decisions that best belong to the American people.
And finally, the chairman, Pat Leahy, thanked Ms. Kagan for her time and said she had answered questions more fully than any recent nominee.
I respect your pledge, and I take so seriously what you pledge all of us here, that you will do your best to consider every case impartially, modestly, with commitment to principle, in accordance with law. Sister General Kagan, I believe you, and we stand recess.
And we are still here. I'm with Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, and Tom Goldstein, who is the founder of SCOTUS blog. Tom and Nina, Kagan repeatedly referred to judicial modesty, to restraint, humility, reverence for precedent and subtle law. But there seemed to be a lot of anxiety that once she gets to the court, she'll somehow flip out of that.
Well, it's really interesting. These are all expressions. This whole framework is the text written by nominee John Roberts. He was, everybody agrees, the most stunning and successful nominee witness that almost any of us, that any of us have ever seen.
I'll second that.
So every witness since John Roberts has used the same expressions and the same words. They're reading from the same choir book. Some do it better than others, but they all use the same script. And I can't see us getting away from that script since so far it's been pretty successful.
Leahy described Kagan as more open than other nominees. Is there something that we didn't know about Elena Kagan that we know now, do you think, Tom?
Well, I think we know about her as an individual more than we know a lot more about her view of the law. We know as an individual that she can really take fire. She's not at all intimidated. And she can at the same time be pretty funny. She can disarm you, including people who are very intense and really don't like what she stands for. I think we also learned she has an awful lot of Republican friends. Every time she would be attacked, Senator Leahy would pull out a letter from some Republican nominee to something or a former Republican Solicitor General saying that she's the greatest thing ever. She's also very loyal to them. She said Miguel Estrada, who was an icon of conservatives, who was blocked from taking a federal appellate judge here in Washington, D.C. by Democrats, should have been confirmed to the Court of Appeals and deserved to be on the Supreme Court, too, was qualified for it. And so she stood behind him, and I think that was impressive personally.
And he stood behind her also.
Yes. Yeah, so she certainly did.
You know, one of the things, I think that she actually was a more successful witness than Sonia Sotomayor because she's schooled in the ways of Washington. Sotomayor had been a judge for 17 years. This is not her lifestyle. It is not the lifestyle of judges to come appear before congressional committees and hobnob with these people. And it showed. She was a perfectly good witness, but she was restricted in her, and Kagan was much more relaxed.
Now, there was a closed-door session to take place right after the meeting. What happens in a closed-door session?
Well, normally, they talk, if they want to, about the FBI file. This is a direct outgrowth of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings. So that if any charges made in the FBI file that would be embarrassing to discuss in public, they can do it in private. In this one, there are about 1,200 pages of documents from the Clinton Library that President Clinton let the senators see but did not allow to be released to the public because they involved people's privacy, other than his privacy, that is. And so they can ask questions about those in this session.
So when they come out of their closed-door meeting, what happens then?
Well, now we have the process of written questions and answers from Kagan, and we're on a clock for about a month away from a vote on the Senate floor, probably towards 5 days or so before they break for the summer in early August.
So do you think that the committee will vote right after the 4th of July recess?
Not quite. I think they have to give time for her to
answer. A couple of weeks,
right,
as you said.
For her to answer questions and for them to digest them and then vote.
And so that she would be on a track to be on the bench if she's confirmed by the time the court opens the first Monday in October.
Easily.
Now, if she makes it in and she becomes Justice Kagan, still nothing changes. It's still 5-4 on that court, isn't that right?
Well, assuming it's not 6-3.
Well, good point.
I mean, I don't know Elena Kagan well, but I have no idea what she thinks on a great many of these issues. On some of them, I have a fairly good idea. On others, I really don't.
I don't think we know about particular issues. I do think we can say she's probably on the left. But the left lost its leader this year when John Paul Stevens retired. And that's just not replaceable by another vote that's like him. It takes a while to grow into this job, and she hasn't been a judge at all.
So we have a lot to that we'll be looking for. Thank you both very much. Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Tom Goldstein is the founder of the SCOTUS blog. He's also an attorney at the Washington law firm Akin Gump. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you've been listening to a special report from NPR News.